This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. In 2015, world leaders overwhelmingly backed the elimination of female genital mutilation, or FGM, as one of the targets in the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. How widespread is this practice globally, and is it happening here in Malaysia? Joining me now to discuss this and more are Sivanandi Thinendaran. She's the Executive Director of the Asian Pacific Resource and Research Center for Women, or ARRO, and Rosanna Issa, the Executive Director of Sisters in Islam. Welcome, ladies. How are you today?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Always good to have you both on this show. So we're talking about this as, you know, it was International Day of Zero Tolerance for FGM. You know, that was just last week on the 6th of February. And I know there have been growing international efforts to stop FGM. But for us Malaysians, I know last February, the CEDAW committee said that women's rights had regressed, you know, and they urged our government to abolish FGM. And how has Malaysia, you know, responded to that?
Following the CEDAW session, there were very, very strong statements made by the CEDAW committee and those by CEDAW committee from Muslim countries. Mm-hmm. And they expressed, you know, their indignation that FGM is still practiced in Malaysia. But the response by the government during the constructive dialogue itself, the Ministry of Health representative actually stated that, you know, they tried to differentiate between the practice in Malaysia, which is female circumcision, mm-hmm. from FGM. And they said that, you know, to say female circumcision is FGM is a misnomer. They also explained that what Malaysia practices is actually the removal of the prepuce, which is the fold of the skin surrounding the clitoris, mm-hmm. which, according to the World Health Organization, is a type 1 FGM.
Okay, all right. And I also know that last year, our DPM, who's also our Women, Family and Community Development Minister, she maintained that female circumcision is part of Malaysian culture.
I don't think it's a Malaysian culture. Mm-hmm. Perhaps it's a Malay culture and strongly influenced by religion. And definitely, if it's a cultural practice, it is something that definitely can be changed. Okay. For the better.
Yeah, because she did say something about it not being how it's female circumcision here was unlike that with that's practiced in African countries.
She said that, you know, but I think we also need to look at the statistics because there is acknowledgement that, you know, 83 to 85% of girls or women who are circumcised apparently do not experience any harm. Mm-hmm. But we also need to ask the question about, you know, the remaining 15 to 17%, yeah. What happened to them?
Right. Yeah. And I also believe that the CEDAW committee members from Muslim countries like Egypt, they have actually asked the Malaysian government to revisit the 2009 decision by the National Fatwa Committee, mm-hmm. That made it obligatory and, you know, urged the government to abolish it. And what has our response been to that?
I don't think there has been any response or any moves made to abolish the fatwa. Mm-hmm. I would like to state that the fatwa that was, promulgated at that time by the Majlis Fatwa Kebangsaan, the National Fatwa Committee, is actually an opinion. It has not been gazetted by any of the states.
Okay.
Therefore, you know, really there is no obligation to follow it. So that fatwa actually makes it an obligatory practice. Mm. But if it brings harm, then it should not. So I think we also need to add that point that the fatwa says if it brings harm. And I think there is some harm that is experienced according to these statistics here.
Okay, all right. And, you know, just asking people in the office here, there was some confusion between what constitutes female genital mutilation and cutting versus female circumcision. Maybe you could help, you know, those who don't understand, could you help differentiate the two?
Yeah, so the WHO actually defines FGM, female genital mutilation, all comprising of all procedures that involve partial or total removal of the external female genitalia,
okay.
or other injury to the female genital organs for non-medical reasons. And they classify it according to four types, of which four is the least. So in Malaysia, they like to refer to the procedure that's done as female circumcision, and officials, as Rosanna has said at the CEDAW session, tried to defend the practice that the type 4 followed in Malaysia should not be classified as FGM. Mm. Unfortunately, that's how the WHO itself actually classifies it.
Okay.
So that is why activists have also tried to include it as not only FGM, but female genital cutting as well. So they usually call it FGM/FGC, you know, but that's our own lingo as well. And they like to think that the practice is harmless, but it's actually a violation of bodily autonomy, you know, because these babies are not clearly asked their consent in the first place. Mm-hmm. It is comes from a belief of wanting to control female sexuality and the belief that female sexuality indeed should be controlled.
In the first
you know,
place,
so
right.
that itself shows that it's a gender practice of gender inequality, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And if there are no medical benefits to FGM, FGC, and, you know, then why do it at all, you know, is the question that most of us are asking.
Mm-hmm. So, and who generally are at risk of, you know, FGM or FGC, as you mentioned?
So, clearly, young girls and women. And the age at which women and girls are subjected to the practice can vary from the first week to month and until 6 years of age.
Okay.
And of course, in African countries, it has been documented that this is actually a rite of passage of womanhood that happens culturally at, you know, circa from 12 to 16, 17 years old, right? Mm-hmm. So, but that's not the practice which is existent in Malaysia.
Okay. I was reading a UNICEF report. It's an older report, it's 2013. And it said that there is a degree of discrepancy between the low support of FGM, FGC, and a high prevalence of its practice. You know, even in countries in which most girls and women are cut, a significant proportion of these populations actually oppose the practice. So, you know, what explains the continuity of the practice of FGM and FGC?
Right. I think there is, you know, what Siva talked about in relation to the control of female sexuality, I think that's the main driving force.
Okay.
Because definitely in my generation and growing up amongst, you know, my relatives, the talk behind all of this is all about, you know, making sure that, you know, the girl does not become promiscuous and therefore this practice needs to be carried on.
Sure.
But I think we also need to recognize the fact that actually this is a harmful ideology. Maybe statistically, you know, women do not experience harm because it's either a type 4 pricking or piercing or a type 1. But I think the ideology behind, you know, women that, you know, that they need to be controlled.
Right.
I think this is something that needs to be talked about a little bit more openly within our society.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we don't know is, you know, to what extent actually a woman's sexual life, the quality of her sexual experience is actually being affected by the female genital cutting.
Okay, so I mean, essentially, it seems that these are, it's cultural and social factors that are cited for performing FGM,
yes,
correct?
Yes.
Okay, and that even though it varies from region to region.
Yes, and also to add to that, you know, because sometimes what we constitute as lack of acceptance and acceptance, you know, there has been actually a great deal of push by governments at the international level. And definitely the focus has largely been on the African continent, you know. So they have had to, through these human rights mechanisms, procedures, as well as development sector organizations, they had to kind of pass laws which actually kind of said that they were against FGM, right? But as we know that a law is only a law in paper unless there is really concerted effort by those governments to actually go and advertise and inform the people and build up awareness amongst the citizens on why that practice is not cultural. So that's where I guess you see the gap between, you know, what seems to be a widespread lack of acceptance of the practice, but again, a high prevalence, right?
Yeah.
So I think that that's where you translate the law into actual practice, you know. However, the focus has not been in Asia, You know, so that is why we are seeing many of the governments in the region actually not having had that pressure from the international community to eradicate such a practice.
Okay. All right. I'm speaking today to Sivanandi Thanandaran. She's the Executive Director of the Asian Pacific Resource and Research Center for Women, or ARRO, and Rosanna Issa. She's the Executive Director of Sisters in Islam. And we're discussing how, you know, globally we need to end the practice of female genital mutilation and cutting. After this quick break, we're going to talk about, you know, the so-called health benefits, if there are any, for FGMC. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. In the studio with me today, two very lovely ladies, Sivanandi Thanandaran. She's the Executive Director of the Asian Pacific Resource and Research Center for Women, or ARRO, and Rosanna Issa, the Executive Director of Sisters in Islam. And we're discussing ending female genital mutilation and cutting, the whole practice of it. So it was International Day of Zero Tolerance for FGM just last week. And, you know, both of you have been working, you know, you released a joint statement, you've been working on this. But just talk to me a little bit, you know, in terms of global statistics, how many women and girls are affected by this practice?
Well, according to last year's data from UNICEF, FGM threatens about 3 million girls annually, and at least 200 million girls and women have been cut in 30 countries. You know, and it was practiced mainly in Africa, mainly the northern areas of Somalia, Ethiopia, Kenya. But in Asia, it also happens in southern Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, southern Philippines, Maldives, and the Borah communities of Pakistan and India.
Okay.
And actually, a number of our countries like Indonesia really kind of elevate the statistics because if it's a very high prevalence.
Okay. And do we know the statistics here in Malaysia by any chance?
In Malaysia, there is no government data publicly available to know the extent of how many girls and women have been cut. But small-scale studies by individual indicate a huge majority of girls and women are made to undergo FGM. And I think the study that Rosanna mentioned, Dr. Mazna Dahluiz, who is an associate professor at University of Malaya's Department of Social and Preventive Medicine, did a study in 2012 with 1,196 respondents. And in that study, 93% of the Malay women had undergone circumcision.
93?
Yes, with 83% of respondents citing reasons for religious obligations, 35% for hygiene purposes, and 15% to control one's sexual desire, and 7% to satisfy their partners.
Their partners? So that means it was done as adults then?
No, no. It was, I mean, like, they thought that if you were a circumcised woman, you pleased your partner greater.
I see. Yeah. Okay, okay. So it was still done when, it was still performed when they were younger. Can this be performed when you are an adult?
This is a very interesting question, and you will be surprised. And this is the other spectrum of FGMC, which sometimes we don't address. In many Western countries, apparently, women are dissatisfied by the appearance of their labia and actually choose to undergo different forms of procedures such as hudectomy, labiaplasty, in order to modify their genitalia to look to be more aesthetically pleasing, you know. And so I think that that's what we need to really critique, because that is seen as a choice, right? So we are saying this FGM, FGC performed on girls who are perhaps unaware of their full extent of choices, are forced to undergo FGM, FGC. But in these Western countries, is that also not FGM? You know, so I think that that's something that needs to be interrogated. Mm-hmm. But of course, underlying both of these phenomena is the fact that women actually think that their genitalia needs to become aesthetically pleasing.
Yeah. To whom?
To whom?
Yeah,
exactly.
That was the first question that came to my
mind.
Know? To whom?
And there was, I remember, a Swedish sexuality organization, RFSU, which actually, you know, did a campaign in Sweden, and they got women to kind of document the variety of how female genitalia can look like, you know. And it's exactly that. That's diversity. And we have to kind of go towards a direction of body positivity, even with regard that we are constructed differently as women.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder who is, you know, kind of dictating what it should look like. You know, what is that Never mind. Let's not go there. Let's not go there.
I was shocked. It is a phenomena. There is apparently a designer labia, a designer vagina. So yes, this is happening.
Someone's making money out
of this. Someone is, evidently. All right, we need to have a discussion about that another time. But back to FGM, FGC. Does it actually have any health benefits? Have we seen any sort of studies in that or whatever?
The International Federation of Gynecologists and Obstetricians, they have actually released a study quite some time ago, I think in the 90s or maybe late 80s, to say that there are no health benefits. They actually have a strong policy that FGM, you know, that states, you know, there is no health benefits to FGM and FGC, and therefore it should not be performed.
Okay, and how can FGM actually affect the health of women and girls?
There are several short-term and long-term complications. Immediate issues include severe pain, excessive bleeding or hemorrhage, genital tissue swelling, urinary problems, injuries surrounding to genital tissue, shock and death in the very worst case scenario. Long-term consequences can include long-term urinary and vaginal problems, menstrual issues like painful menstruations, difficulty in passing menstrual blood, and sexual problems, right? Pain during intercourse. And decreased satisfaction. But of course, this will vary according to the type of FGM, FGC that the girl has undergone.
And does it also have any, are there any consequences for childbirth and things like that?
Definitely in the type 2, type 3, where completely, you know, it's infibulation. And what happens in the process of infibulation, which is a very painful thing to describe, which is basically all of the external genitalia are cut off and the woman's vagina is sewn up, you know, and hence what happens is that during the first intercourse, the man is supposed to cut a part of it and enter, so to speak. And this because it has really unnaturally constricted the vaginal passage, then it is difficult for babies to pass through. And that's where maternal mortality also occurs.
Right. And this is a common practice as well.
This is not in Malaysia,
not in
but,
Malaysia,
yes,
but
other parts of the world. And that's where it really got the attention of the health community and all that, why this practice needs to end.
Right. Okay. Is there also a link between FGM, FGC and the risk of HIV infection?
I think that since long-term health risks include chronic pain, reproductive tract infections, birth complications and psychological consequences, so there is an increased risk of bleeding during intercourse and this may increase the risk of HIV transmission. And the increased prevalence of herpes in women is subjected to FGM may also increase the risk for HIV infection, as genital herpes is a risk factor in the transmission of HIV.
Okay. So plenty of health, I mean, no health benefits, basically, and a lot of risks is, is what I'm getting from this. Okay.
And I believe that, you know, Rage did a documentary a year back or so, The Hidden Cut, and you can hear actually a midwife telling the journalist how she uses the same knife on 3 to 4 girls at a time, which is, you know, increases the risk of infection, because especially if it is not properly sterilized, instruments are utilized.
Okay. So we've spoken about the health. What about the psychological effects of FGM and FGC?
So FGM also has several psychological impacts. There's depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, low self-esteem. These have all been documented. But more importantly is, of course, the way that it kind of shapes the psyche, you know, of women in society, that a woman's sexuality needs to be controlled. And, you know, expressing sexual desire or sexual pleasure is something that is perhaps sign of a wild woman, you know, and I think that this is something that is harmful for women to grow up with, and especially when they engage in relationships, right? And I think that in order to have a fulfilling relationships, a full frank expression of not only, you know, all of the other aspects, but also, you know, the sexual pleasure aspect is something that is important. So I think that it kind of does not allow a woman to express or understand herself in her full being.
Yeah, because I mean, what we get from it is that, okay, for one, it's to curb their sexual desires, what, fine. But also then means you're not even allowed to enjoy sexual intercourse, even if you are, you know, legally married, you're doing everything.
That's
in
right.
the, it's, you're just not allowed to enjoy anything with regard to that. Okay. You mentioned the different types of FGM. Which types are the most common? And I mean, did we go through all the different types that can be performed?
Yeah. So type one is the partial or total removal of the clitoris and or the prepuce. And type two is the partial or total removal of the clitoris and the labia minora, or with or without excision of the labia majora. Type three, which is the one we were talking about with the maternal mortality effects and all of that, is the narrowing of the vaginal orifice by cutting and bringing together the labia minora and or the labia majora to create a type of seal, with or without the excision of the clitoris. And in most instances, the cut edges of the labia are stitched together, which is described as infibulation. And then you have type 4, which is all other harmful procedures to the female genitalia for non-medical purposes, whether it's pricking, piercing, incising, scraping, cauterization. Mm-hmm. And in Malaysia, type 1 and type 4 is common. And we all used to think we only had type 4. And Rosanna has a very, can tell you, when did we start including type 1 in the types of FGM, FGC performed in Malaysia?
Yeah. Well, I mean, definitely from what was reported by the Ministry of Health at the CEDAW session, it says that it's type 1 that is being practiced. But the interesting thing is, given that type 1, you know, the difference between type 1 and type 4, you know, to some extent, you know, when did it occur to, you know, medical practitioners or even within society, that there must be some level of harm that's being done even with the practice of type 1. Mm-hmm. And so what is being practiced, apparently type 4, is also becoming common now. So I think within the psyche, there is some level of acknowledgement that there is harm mm-hmm. in the practice of type 1, therefore type 4 is being practiced.
Okay. All right. So there is something, like you said, there is acknowledgement. But is FGM even required by certain religions?
I'm not quite sure with the other religions.
Okay.
Definitely in Islam, you know, we have heard the different opinions. But I think we also need to emphasize certain things. One, that within the life of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, that he had never practiced it within his own family, mm-hmm. To his daughters. I think it was perhaps practiced within the community of Medina when there was the migration of the Prophet from Mecca to Medina. And I think there were also hadith that were acknowledging those practices. And the Prophet admittedly did not prevent, but also did say that as long as there is no harm mm-hmm. that comes to the woman. It needs to be acknowledged as well that the Quran does not say anything about the practice or the necessity mm-hmm. for FGM or FGC to be done upon women.
Okay.
Well, for me, I had met a number of experts from the University of Al-Azhar, which is based in Cairo. And for many decades, it was considered the center of learning for Islamic understanding on how do you reconcile Islam and the modern world. Mm-hmm. And they had actually made a number of fatwas. So I know that Al-Azhar has definitively produced fatwas saying that it is not required. Mm-hmm. And in the severe cases that as practiced in Egypt, where it is some of the most severe forms of FGM, FGC, that it is actually un-Islamic to do that level of harm, mm-hmm. right? So I think that, and because a lot of attention was also given to Africa, as I explained earlier, right, in the international development community, so you actually have a lot of religious preachers in a number of countries like Mali, Senegal, and all of that, who actually have come up to say that it is not required by religion, you know, because they have examined the text and they find that there are many progressive differing opinions. And I think that this is something that, you know, even us, when we are formulating these opinions, perhaps, you know, we should be considering the opinions of University Al-Azhar and all in formulating our own understanding. And I think that because they all share the similar books and they are from the same school, it is easier to actually have those progressive opinions transcend some national boundaries.
Okay, but since, you know, a lot of people cite FGM, it's part of their cultural tradition, you know, it's you know, who has the right to interfere in these age-old traditions, you know, does anyone actually have the right to do that?
I think when there is harm, I think anyone who has concern about what is being practiced upon women and girls, everyone has a right to speak up against such practices. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, it's age old, but we also need to interrogate the fact that, you know, if it brings no benefit at all, you know, to the woman or the child, then why do we need to practice something that is based on, you know, a tradition that we really don't understand its origins, mm-hmm. but definitely, you know, in terms of the narrative behind it, it's all about the control of women's sexuality.
And also, like, I mean, like, if you're talking about age-old customs, I mean, this is applicable across so many different practices, right? So, I mean, whether it's the practice of dowry, which really burdens parents and, you know, devalues girl children, whether it's the practice of, you know, many years ago, I mean, like, you know, they used to burn widows on the sati,
yeah,
right?
Yep.
And I'm kind of happy that practice ended.
Yes. So and the binding of feet.
Yes.
You know?
So I think that, you know, yeah. So the idea of women being equal members in society is something that is evolving. Mm-hmm. And in line with that, then, you know, if we can actually consider and improve, we should be allowed to change age-old traditions, you know.
I was reading something called the medicalization of FGM. What does that mean, actually?
So the medicalization of FGM or FGC refers to the act being performed, you know, by doctors and within like hospital settings or clinical settings or other members of the health profession, right? The phenomena is not something that is new or unknown. And WHO is actually opposed to all forms of FGM, is emphatically against the practice being carried out by healthcare providers, you know. And our position is similar to that. I think that there are two aspects to issues such as FGM, FGC, which is one is the health perspective and then the other one is the rights perspective. Yeah. So generally in the earlier years, the advocacy was very much about, you know, the ill health, you know, so the bleeding and you know, so government said, well, you know, it's so unhygienic being done by the traditional be done. So now let's make it clean and there's no infection and move it to the clinical setting.
Yeah.
So that's where then the rights dialogue really needs to go hand in hand with the health dialogue as well.
Sure.
So just because you have the risk of bleeding, infection and all of that doesn't make the practice right.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, similarly, you can see actually a number of private clinics offering the practice and many people do go to the private clinics to do it, you know. But the medicalization of the FGM, FGC has brought this dilemma for doctors themselves, right? Because of the principle of do no harm. And how do you perform the procedure? And if so, how exactly to do it? You know, so doctors turned to the health ministry, you know, which then consulted the National Fatwa Committee, as explained by Rosanna. And it was considered a religious question.
I see.
See, and then they issued the fatwa in 2009.
Yeah.
Right. And but however, the health ministry has refrained from issuing any medical guidelines since Malaysia is a signatory to international conventions, and issuing guidelines would be kind of a violation of those international commitments.
Okay. It does sound like we need not just a local strategy, but a global strategy actually to stop healthcare providers from performing female genital mutilation, would you say?
No, I think for me, you know, there needs to be efforts on many, many fronts.
Sure.
Definitely the religious communities and leaders have an obligation to inform the fact that, you know, there are progressive fatwas in other countries by the Al-Azhar, especially to say that, you know, this is a practice that should not continue and that it is un-Islamic. We should also actually have the Ministry of Health maybe doing a campaign and informing and educating the public to say that female genital cutting doesn't bring any benefit to the girl child, mm-hmm. and therefore it should not be practiced any further. Mm-hmm. And I think within society as well, you know, we need to have this discussion openly so that, you know, there can be more people making more informed decisions over, you know, the girl baby when she is born. Yeah. So far, I think I have met people who have tried to negotiate with their families and to find out more. Definitely the pressure to practice perhaps comes from the families because they've always done it and it's something they thought that, you know, if you break this tradition, then, you know, you're not falling in line with our family's practices. Yeah. But I know that parents have made efforts to find out more and have also made a conscious decision not to continue the practice when their girl child is born.
Because mm-hmm. as we've discussed, there is no benefit to it. There, mm-hmm. I mean, even if you want to talk about controlling women's sexual desires, I don't think that is something that comes as a result of yes. FGM, FGC. Yeah. So, I mean, why continue doing it?
Yes, and the thing is, the conversation about controlling men's desires never actually come
non-existent.
Up. Non-existent, yeah.
Okay, all right. So there is a lot of efforts and actions that need to be focused on. You know, I know both of you have been working on this. You've been having lots of discussions and lots of, you know, meetings and all of that. You know, anything positive coming out from all of that, you know, in terms of reaching the grassroots and getting more people, you know?
No, I think we're actually just at the point of public discourse at the moment.
Okay.
Yeah. So definitely I see this something as a long-term effort. Mm-hmm. But what I also would like to point out is the CEDAW committee had actually issued a directive yes. to the government to submit a written report in the year 2020 to explain and clarify what are the steps, positive steps being taken to engage with religious leaders, communities towards eliminating this practice.
Yeah, and I also think that sharing practices from other countries, like for example, we know that Bangladesh and in most of Pakistan, besides the Bora community,
Saudi Arabia,
the practice simply doesn't exist, you know. So actually creating some of this awareness of the how in Muslim majority countries, you know, the reality is completely different. And I know that earlier on in an interview, one of our Bangladeshi staff had actually mentioned to Sharad in Astro Awani that, you know, there's no in religious leaders in Bangladesh maintain that there is no credible hadith on female circumcision at all. You know, so I think that working with the community is very important. And I think it's great that a lot of families who do have that information are actually making that decision for yeah. their daughters and, you know, ending the practice itself. But also that there is a very simple methodology under the Sustainable Development Goals and under the goal of gender equality, ending the practice of female genital mutilation and female genital cutting is one of those targets and indicators yeah. mentioned. Yeah. And the government can utilize that in line with the, you know, follow-up to the CEDAW mm-hmm. recommendations as well, you know, to actually create a sort of a cohesive program that does not mean like forcing people to end the practice, but actually kind of creating awareness from the ground up that a different world is possible for yeah. girls and women, you know, and that's already happening across the world.
Yeah, so it's strange that it's not happening here. But, you know, something that the DPM did say, I mean, when she said that, you know, it's a cultural Malaysian practice, she did say that her ministry would look into the issue and discuss it. And she said, I quote, if it doesn't give any benefit, then we should do something. So maybe that's a positive thing from all of this.
Yes, that is positive, and I hope that, you know, there will be further conversations to make sure that, you know, we keep to our international commitments mm-hmm. In the interest of all the girls and women in Malaysia.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining me today.
Thank you, Juliet.
I've been speaking to Sivanandi Thanendaran. She's the Executive Director of the Asian Pacific Resource and Research Center for Women, or ARRO, and Rosanna Issa, the Executive Director of Sisters in Islam. And we were discussing the move to end female genital mutilation and female genital cutting, not just here in Malaysia, but across the world. If you'd like to find out more about both their organizations, you can visit their websites, sistersinislam.org and arrow.org.my. If you missed any part of this interview or any previous Live and Learn interviews, you can search for the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play and the App Store. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.